We're happy at this time to continue our lesson in the book of Ezekiel. We're still in this 8th chapter, and last time we'd gotten through the 12th verse. In this 8th chapter, Ezekiel has been taken back to Jerusalem now in a vision, right there to the temple itself, and in the temple, in the gate that went into the inner court, in the entryway, was this image of jealousy. He doesn't tell us exactly what idol this was. It doesn't matter what idol it was, because any idol that the people would use would be a source then of jealousy to God. It would bring about God's jealousy and God's wrath. So it really is more instructive to us to not know which specifically this was in the way of an idol, because it allows us to make the proper application. Any idol is an idol of jealousy to God. And then Ezekiel sees this hole in the wall. He digs it open larger and finds a door. And he's allowed to go into a chamber, and in there is all kinds of the idols of the house of Israel portrayed upon the wall round about. He sees 70 of the elders there, and these are the predominant people of Israel, and they're all worshiping with the censer in his hand and the thick cloud of incense going up, and it's just an unbelievable thing. And these people are doing this in private, in secret. They think that God doesn't see and doesn't know what they're doing, that they can get away with it. And it's a terrible, terrible thing. It's a shock to Ezekiel. And so he says to Ezekiel in verse 12, "Son of man, hast thou seen what the ancients of the house of Israel do in the dark, every man in the chambers of his imagery? For they say, the Lord had seen us not, the Lord seeth us not, and the Lord hath forsaken the earth." So he asked Ezekiel, "Do you see what's happening?" And it's as though he were putting the question to Ezekiel to show how shocking and how unbelievable this thing was. "You see what's happening here, son of man?" Here Ezekiel is in captivity in the kingdom of Babylon. They're looking for, that is, the people there in that captivity are looking for this captivity to be brought to an end shortly. They are expecting Jerusalem to shape up and God to forgive the nation and let it come back. But as Ezekiel goes over and looks, he sees the sin is as bad as ever in Jerusalem. And Jerusalem has not improved at all. The temple itself is desecrated by this idolatry, and God is forced to leave his holy place. And so it's a shocking thing to Ezekiel to see this. So now, beginning where we left off in this 8th chapter of Ezekiel at the 13th verse, "He said also unto me, Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations that they do." And so you might wonder at this point, what could be greater? What could be greater than what he'd already seen? But it certainly is going to be more abominations. And he describes them here as greater abominations that they do. "Then he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north. And behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz." Now here Ezekiel is brought right to the gate that's going into the inner court, the court of the priests, and he sees there by this gate women are sitting there weeping for Tammuz. Now we need to pause here just a little while and study something about this Tammuz to see what a terrible, terrible thing was happening. There is some division of opinion as to exactly what god this Tammuz was. Some say that he was a Syrian and Phoenician god. Now, any of these theories that are correct, any one of them is probably as bad as another. But let's notice what we can find about him. Others say that he's a similar god to this Greek god called Adonis, A-D-O-N-I-S. Others say he's similar to Isis, the Egyptian god. And still other authorities have some good, strong historical background to show that Tammuz was actually the illegitimate son of Nimrod's wife, Semiramis. Now let's look just for a moment at Nimrod. Nimrod was a mighty hunter. During the time of Nimrod, there were no true organized cities and nations as we know them now. But because of Nimrod's great ability to hunt and to protect the people from wild beasts, he was a leader. And he seems to be, from the Bible account, the first to organize cities and nations, or people into a society that follows some type of a government. He is the originator of such cities and nations as Babel. And as you know, Babel was the very first thing mentioned so far as rebellion against God in the building of this mighty tower, the Tower of Babel. That was the place where God had to cause the multiple language to confuse the people so they wouldn't be so single-minded in carrying out this work against God and rebelling against God with this tower building. Tower building has always been a mark of idolatry. It's always been a mark of those who rebel against God. And the remnants of these towers are seen today even in the steeples of the various so-called church buildings. But at any rate, Nimrod was a man who was rebellious against God. He organized people so that they were into nations or cities and with walls built around them. Nimrod was a religious figure in the eyes of the people. And then when Nimrod died, his wife, to be known as his widow, whose name was Semiramis, had an illegitimate son, and this illegitimate son's name was Tammuz. Now, she stated, though, that this son was actually a return to life of Nimrod. It was a reincarnation, a return back from the dead of the person Nimrod, or the god Nimrod. And we see here where the Satan is beginning to really start some true counterfeit religion. One of the most effective weapons that Satan has is to know what God's plan is, and then he sets about to establish a counterfeit that's similar to, not the same as, but similar to God's true religion, and then he deceives the people into following this counterfeit. Way back there where the people were going to build this Tower of Babel, and they said, let us make a name. This word name is spelled Shem, and it really means a counterfeit of the offspring of Shem. The offspring of Shem were to be God's true people. That's the people from which the Israelites descended. But Nimrod's family descended from Ham. But it seemed that they were going to mimic or counterfeit the things that God had made for the descendants of Shem. Well, as we look at this counterfeit religion, we see many things springing up there that have been used among the idolatrous and heathenistic nations for centuries. But these things have crept into the people of God. Back in the Old Testament times, these practices were taken up by His holy nation then, and even today there are those who claim to be Christians who are practicing these idolatrous, mimicking, counterfeit things that were started back during the time of Nimrod. And this god Tammuz figures in a lot of this. Now, as we said, he was the illegitimate son of Nimrod's wife, Semiramis. And so she passed off his birth as being a reincarnation of Nimrod himself. So he was symbolic of the coming back to life of Nimrod. And this was celebrated by the act of recognizing and celebrating the winter and summer solstice. Now, the winter solstice is the time when the sun is furthest south of the equator, occurring about December 21st or 22nd. The summer solstice is when the sun is the furthest north of the equator, occurring about June 21st or 22nd. And this has been celebrated for years and years and years, for centuries. Long before Christ came, it has been looked upon as a rebirth of life and of material things. It's when the earth begins to produce again after the vegetation has died or been removed from the earth. And so it's really a materialistic celebration, a time of the giving of gifts and the rejoicing again, because now we're going to have more production from the earth. And it's also tied in with the worship of the sun as a god, and that's the S-U-N. And we see then that this has been brought into the realm of many people who claim to be Christians when they practice the so-called Christ Mass about this time of year. It's really a ritualistic thing that was borrowed from paganism, heathenism, and idolatry. And it originated back at the time of Nimrod and the fake return of Nimrod back to life in the form of Tammuz. Also, we find that this situation with Tammuz and his mother is one of the first instances that we know of the mother and child worship. And most religions have some kind of a mother and child figure that they worship. And this has been also falsely brought into the Christian religion, so that there is a worship of the Virgin Mary and her child, and this is never intended to be, but still it is done. Also, we find that this name Tammuz, the symbol of the name is a T, which is a cross. And it's also this cross also stands for the Ptah, or the Egyptian cross. And so this is an origin of another counterfeit religion, and that is using the cross as a religious symbol, simply using it as an abbreviation for the T in the name Tammuz. Here again we find that though this is widely practiced in the so-called realm of Christianity, never was it intended that the cross be used as a Christian symbol or as any type of religious symbol under any of the dispensations of the people of God. So you can see what abomination this is. And when he says in the 13th verse, "Thou shalt see greater abomination that they do," how really deeply involved they were in sin and in idolatry. Here these women were weeping for Tammuz. Now, according to Tammuz, was supposed to have died, and then the women were weeping because of his death, and then he would return to life, and they would rejoice because of his coming back again to life. Now, there were many other very sinful, abominable things that happened in connection with this worship of Tammuz, but we're going to just mention the things that are recorded here. The women sat there weeping for Tammuz. And so Ezekiel saw this, and it is a very paganistic practice. It has to do with the temporal blessings of this life. It's something that's leaving the true God of heaven completely out of their ideas. God had nothing to do with this. He never taught them to do this. He never condoned it. He would not share with it, and yet the people were forcing God to stomach this very thing. And so God had to abandon the temple. And today, when we embrace these similar practices, we have to believe that they're just as much an abomination today as they ever were in the time of Ezekiel. We have to believe that God has the same feeling about it, and we have to believe that God is going to treat us the same way that he treated those people eventually when we embrace this kind of a practice. It's an abomination. We need to educate ourselves. We need to recognize it for what it is. And just because the high and the mighty people of the nation are doing it, those that are most learned and involved in it, does not make it right, does not make it proper, does not make God have to like it or accept it. Now in verse 15, "Then said he unto me, Hast thou seen this, O son of man?" Now he's again asking Ezekiel, can you believe that this is happening? Have you seen what I'm showing you? Do you get the picture? The people over in Chaldea are thinking that Jerusalem is repenting, that God's fixing to bring them back from the captivity. But when they look at the activities of Jerusalem, well, Jerusalem is as bad as they've ever been. They've never done anything to improve themselves. So he says, "Do you see this, O son of man? Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abomination than these." He's going to show him something now that even seems to be worse than that. Greater than these. Verse 16, "And he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house." Now Ezekiel finally goes on into the inner court, which is the court of the priests. "And behold, at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men, with their backs toward the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east, and they worshiped the sun toward the east." Here's the picture Ezekiel saw. He saw 25 men. And there's been a lot of conjectures to who these 25 men represent, but the most logical thing seems to be, since they were in the temple of the priest, that these 25 men were priests. 24 of them representing the 24 courses that served in the temple, with then one representing the high priest, making a number of 25. Now, instead of them facing toward the temple of the Lord, or toward the area where the most holy place was, that contained the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat and the cherubim, instead of them facing toward that area, toward God, toward the seat of God, they had their backs turned toward the Lord, or the temple of the Lord, and their faces were turned toward the east, and they worshiped the sun toward the east. So we see here the plain old worship of the sun god, or the sun as a god. Now, God never intended for this to happen. He does not permit man to worship the sun and be well-pleasing to God. In Deuteronomy 17, he specifically talks about this, beginning with the second verse. If there be found among you within any of thy gates, which the Lord thy God giveth thee, man or woman, that hath wrought wickedness in the sight of the Lord thy God, and transgressing his covenant, and hath gone and served other gods, and worshipped them, either the sun, or moon, or any of the host of heaven, which I have not commanded, and it be told thee, and thou hast heard of it, and inquired diligently, and behold, it be true, and the thing certain, that such abomination is wrought in Israel, then shalt thou bring forth that man or that woman, which have committed that wicked thing, unto thy gates, even that man or that woman, and shall stone them with stones till they die. At the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall he that is worthy of death be put to death, but at the mouth of one witness he shall not be put to death. So we see here that God specifically legislated about worshiping any of these heavenly bodies such as the sun. It was a sin that was worthy of death to be guilty of it. Well, here we find the priest doing this in the temple, turning their back on the true and living God and worshiping this sun toward the east. Now, sun worship had always been a very old type of idolatry. It's been practiced from the very earliest times. It is seen in many of the more modern cultures. We find among the American Indians and many others, they all had some kind of veneration to give to the sun as some kind of a god. And here it even gotten into the very people of God right over in the temple of God at Jerusalem. And just because the high and learned people were doing it, because these 25 men of the priesthood were doing it, does not make it right, does not make it permissible. Today, the apostate church has many symbols of the sun among its religious usages. Even the idea of facing toward the east in any kind of a prayerful or worshipful mode comes from this, and it is an abomination of God. It is sin, and it will not be tolerated by God. Now, of course, people will say it's such a harmless thing to look upon the sun like this. Well, the sun is something that God has placed here. It's a natural thing. It's such a powerful force in our lives. Surely we can not be condemned for treating the sun in this manner. But the sun is the lesser light. It's a reflection of the light of the true God, and it's not to be used this way, and God does not permit it. Now, originally, man just worshipped the sun in this way. Then later, he began to create images and pillars that he would set up and worship the sun with the shadow cast on these pillars and many variations of this. And then there was a resurgence back to the original form of just worshiping the sun without using any of the other images. So we might find sun worship in all of its forms as we go throughout history. But nevertheless, it's as an abominable in one form as it is another. And here we have it right in the very temple of God, practiced by the priests. But remember that sun worship is an old practice. It is seen in many of the higher developed cultures of the ancients. Many of these ancient temples had been built in such a way so that at certain times the sun would shine in through an orifice and cast a shadow or cast a light in a certain way and have deep meaning to the people. And it's steeped in idolatry. It's contrary, though, to God. God has never permitted His people to worship in this manner. Verse 17, Then he said unto me, Hast thou seen this, O son of man? Is it a light thing to the house of Judah that they commit the abominations which they commit here? He asked Ezekiel this question, which has obviously only one answer. Is it a light thing to the house of Judah to commit these abominations? Is this something to take lightly, Ezekiel? Isn't this a pretty serious breach, a very serious thing? So that Ezekiel is convinced by what he sees. He is convinced that this nation is worthy of condemnation and destruction. He says, For they have filled the land with violence, and have returned to provoke me to anger, and lo, they put the branch to their nose. And in verse 18 he says, Therefore will I also deal in fury, mine eye shall not spare, neither will I have pity, and though they cry in mine ears with a loud voice, yet will I not hear them. So God is telling Ezekiel that he's justified in condemning these people. This type of behavior is going to bring about wrath from him. They're going to have a terrible punishment. There is going to be no relief from this. There's no way they can avoid it. They've gone beyond, and God has borne with them as long as he possibly will, and now it's going to bring about his wrath, his fury. He says, Mine eyes shall not spare, neither will I have pity. Well, we're going to close at that point. Next time, then, we'll begin with these verses and then continue into chapter 9. Thank you.